Chapter 7. Our table became the focus of a great deal of attention. Many of the tables had portable remote terminals so the customers could keep track of the upcoming matches. This facilitated betting. For the action of those who weren't following the upcoming action via terminal, the game announcer informed everyone of the challenge to
the celebrated Psychodrome star, Rudy Brack!
Via PA. We all heard Mondego's sepulchral voice simultaneously through the interface.
This is an unscheduled interactive gaming option, Mr. Breck. The home audience vote is overwhelmingly in favor of your accepting the challenge. Apparently, since your challenger is also formerly of the Special Service and also biologically augmented, they do not consider that you have an unfair advantage.
Screw that, said Breck. What they're considering is the sight of blood, the ghouls,
he sighed.
Very well, I shall oblige them.
Razine frowned.
I beg your pardon? Were you speaking to me?
To our player master,
Stone told him.
We've just been informed through our interface that the psychodroids want to see Rudy pick up the gauntlet.
And you have no choice in the matter,
Razine said, frowning.
It all depends on how you look at it,
said Breck.
Have a seat, Mr. Razine, and show me how to respond to this challenge.
Razine sat down beside Breck and turned the terminal toward him.
What is your residence registration number?
He said. Breck gave it to him and Razine punched it in.
You're quite certain you want to go through with this,
he said.
I was, after all, hired to watch over you, and I feel I should inform you that Cher has never lost a match. I know him well. He is an unprincipled bastard.
So am I, Mr. Racine,
said Breck.
Go ahead, please.
Very well. Would you please spell your name for me?
Breck did, and Razine punched it in, then punched in the acceptance of the challenge, which was confirmed in seconds over the PA by the game announcer. We watched the odds develop on the screen as bets were placed.
You said he is cyborg,
Breck said. Razine nodded.
Both his arms are bionic, as are his legs and hips. If I were you, I wouldn't waste my time in targeting his groin. There is nothing there except some rather sophisticated artificial plumbing. It's conceivable that you might damage something, but you wouldn't slow him down much. He would not feel any pain. His trunk is only partially organic. He's had extensive Nysteel reinforcement of his skeletal structure, especially in the spinal area. His spinal cord was damaged, and it has been repaired and sheathed in Nysteel. You won't break his back, in other words. His ribcage is also Nysteel, and he has an artificial voice box implanted in a flexible Nysteel trachea. Don't bother trying to hit him in the throat. You will only break your hand.
So where the hell can he hit him?
I said.
The man's a bloody robot.
Hey there, little side note. I don't know what sort of accent I'm supposed to be doing for this guy. He's supposed to be Russian and Irish. I wasn't going to try for either of those. He's also lived in Japan for some years, and he's from fucking Mars. But now he's using words like bloody, which is not apropos to any of those backgrounds, so I have no idea what's going on. Anyway, back to it.
I would advise you to try for his nose,
said Razine.
A hard palm heel strike directed upwards should break it and drive the splinters into his brain. He's obviously aware of his vulnerability there, so he will protect himself. You might consider trying to blind him.
You're very well informed,
said Breck.
I don't suppose you'd know who did the work on him by any chance.
So far as I know, it was all performed in a military hospital,
said Razine.
Is that any help?
Breck smiled faintly.
Some,
he said.
It tells me what sort of mortifications he'd
doesn't have.
I don't quite understand,
said Razine.
The service doesn't pay for extras,
Breck explained. He smiled and lifted his own artificial arm.
This was not military issue.
The odds are in,
said Stone, looking at the screen. She grimaced and looked up at Breck. They were 6-1 in the Challenger's favor.
I thought you said he wasn't very well liked.
I said.
He's not,
said Razine.
But why should people lose money because of personal prejudice?
He reached for the terminal and punched in a bet. He bet on Breck.
I appreciate the gesture,
Breck said dryly. Razine shrugged.
At 6-1, the payoff is well worth the risk. Besides, I can afford to lose.
What are the rules?
Said Stone.
What rules?
The game announcer let everybody know that as a result of this
once in a lifetime
matchup, there would be no other competitors in the arena. Breck and Cher would have it to themselves.
Are you well accustomed to zero G?
Said Razine.
That enough,
said Breck.
I've seen Cher fight before,
said Razine.
He will try to work you all over the arena, from low G to zero G and back, to throw you off your reflexes and timing. Don't let him grab hold of you. He could crush you easily. And watch out for his legs. Nice steel bionics pack. A powerful kick.
The announcer called for the contestants, and Breck went down to take his place in the arena. He went through the entrance and the base, and a few moments later, we saw him enter the dome, stripped to the waist, his nice steel arm gleaming. He was in exceptional physical condition, every muscle standing out in sharp relief. Then we saw his opponent for the first time. Cher was a giant. He towered over Breck. His legs were covered with skin suit tights, and he wore soft, lightweight boots. His nice steel arms gleamed in the light of the arena. The nice steel reinforcement of his chest made it seem huge, and the tremendous muscles he had developed to support it gave him the appearance of a bull. His face had the too-tight smoothness of plastic reconstruction, and that somehow made him even more of a robot. There was no character in it. The features were handsome, but the expression was blank. His head, like Razine's, was also shaved, and he looked like a huge, menacing mannequin. I would have expected him to move ponderously, but the low gravity in his bionics gave him a graceful fluidity that seemed incongruous, given his size. Each man had been armed with a nice steel gladius, fashioned after the ancient short sword of the Romans, and a small circular shield that seemed to have little practical use. There was no protective armor of any sort, or protective helmets. Each wore identifying cross belts, white for Cher and black for Breck. They stood across the arena from each other, and the game announcer waited until there was silence. He announced last call for bets, waited a moment or two, then said simply,
"Gentlemen, this match is to the death. You may begin when ready."
He had hardly finished saying the last word when Cher leaped straight up and out, angling toward the top and center of the dome. He turned in midair, rebounded gracefully off the rounded ceiling, then came down at Breck like a dive-bombing eagle. Breck did a standing back somersault a second before Cher reached him, struck against the wall with both feet, somersaulted again in midair, and snapped-kicked Cher as he passed underneath him, sending him smashing into the floor of the arena. Cher struck hard on his chest and bounced. He recovered quickly, tucking up into a ball and spinning with surprising speed, his sword held out away from him. The effect was like that of a buzzsaw. Breck kangarooed away from him toward the center of the arena and the zero-G zone. Cher opened out of his tucked position into something resembling a back dive, jackknifed and reversed motion. He floated down to the floor of the arena lightly and landed on the balls of his feet. The crowd was roaring their excitement. This wasn't some ungainly match involving clumsy new arrivals. This was a battle between two SS veterans who knew how to handle low gravity and the peculiar conditions it created for combat. I was mesmerized. I'd never seen anything like it. Even Razine was watching with rapt attention.
He's good,
said Razine, meaning Breck.
Good moves. Quick, reflexes. I might even win my bet.
What happens if you lose it?
Stone said harshly.
Isn't your employer going to be upset with you for falling down on the job?
I cannot be held responsible for choices you people make of your own free will,
said Razine.
If you should happen to be gunned down in the street, Sonoma would be very angry with me, and rightly so. I would have failed to do my job. But I warned Breck against this match, and more than that, I could not do. This is his own responsibility. I do hope he wins, though. I stand to make a tidy profit on my wager.
Stone didn't seem to appreciate his point. However, I wasn't interested in their debate. I was fascinated by what was happening in the arena. Both men had crossed swords only half a dozen times. Like skilled knife fighters, they used utter economy of motion, not making a single movement that didn't have a purpose. In low to zero G, every movement produced an immediate reaction. There wasn't the slash and flail one might expect of swordplay. There was the wary, careful, intense watching, the precise anticipation, the exacting movement, the sailing through the air like seagulls on an updraft, the tumbling like acrobats on a trapeze. It was like watching a weirdly choreographed underwater ballet. Only this dance was lethal. They would float toward one another, strike with their swords, and rebound in opposite directions, sailing across the zero-G zone slowly, almost imperceptibly losing momentum as they reached the outer edges of the arena. They touched down, rebounded, and came back at one another, attempting to gauge the other's reaction. They would touch down on the surface like balls bouncing in slow motion and circle each other, watching for an opening, each trying to maneuver his opponent toward the central axis zero-G zone in a manner that would place him at a disadvantage. I began to appreciate the intricacy of the deadly game. It was better to move quickly across the zero-G zone as a part of a sustained, controlled maneuver rather than be maneuvered into it unawares. The changes had to be subtle ones, as the entire amphitheater was in a low-G zone, close around the central axis, and most of the arena itself was zero-G. Waitresses kangarooed from table to table delivering drinks. People floated up out of the entrance to the club beneath the stage, settled gently to the floor, and kangarooed to their seats as two men whirled in midair in the domed arena above them, locked in mortal combat. It was macabre and surreal. The crowd was loving it. They were shouting, cheering, excited by the uncertainty of the outcome. Neither man had yet drawn blood, and the crowd knew it would be sudden when it came. There would be time for only one mistake, an irretrievable one, and it would all be over. And then it happened. Breck misjudged a move that Cher had made and tried to recover, backpedaling and moving, apparently unintentionally, too far into the zero-G zone. He started to float, and Cher made his move, committing totally in a fast leap. Breck flung his shield behind him violently, causing a sudden reversal in direction so that his new course would take him and Cher past one another. He swung his sword with his left hand, and as Cher parried him, he snicked out his blades and flicked them across Cher's face. Cher screamed, and the crowd roared, drowning him out. Blood seeped quickly from the five diagonal slashes across Cher's face and floated away in globules as the man writhed in the zero-G zone, covering his face with one hand and swinging his sword around him violently with the other, blindly attempting to keep Breck at bay. But Breck had anticipated the momentum of Cher's leap, and he rebounded from the wall, ping-ponged off the ceiling of the dome, and came down directly on top of Cher as he touched down in the low-gravity zone at the outer edge of the arena. He trapped Cher's sword between his blades and pinned him, legs locked around him, his sword poised over Cher's face. The crowd rose to their feet, screaming wildly, virtually everyone indicating thumbs down. Breck looked at them for a moment, then dropped his sword and gave Cher a quick, sharp uppercut to the jaw. He pushed the limp body away to float off across the arena. He then faced the game's announcer's booth and held up his nice steel hand, blades protruding.
Mr. Breck option for the non-lethal win.
The game announcer said hurriedly over the PA.
Match to Mr. Breck.
Why didn't you kill him?
Razine said when Breck returned to the table.
I did not feel like giving them the satisfaction,
Breck said.
Sorry if I disappointed you.
Razine shrugged.
Not me. I won my bet. The drinks are on me tonight.
You will be getting off easy,
Breck said.
We will not be staying. I had hoped to let the home audience experience the pathetic spectacle of bankrupt new arrivals cutting each other to pieces in your arena. Instead, they experienced the considerably more pathetic spectacle of two crippled veterans performing like monkeys before one crowd of fools. It was hardly the statement I had hoped to make.
You were only trying to help your friend, Colonel Wren,
I said.
Unfortunately, our presence here can only serve to romanticize the Fire Island habitats. But the only way we can discourage people from coming out here is to have something highly unpleasant happen to us, and that's something I'd prefer to avoid.
I keep underestimating you, O'Toole,
said Breck, smiling.
Remind me to
you, Breck!
Cher approached our table, his face an ugly mask, scored with diagonal gashes and streaked with blood. He held a plasma pistol. One eye was caked with blood, but the other stared at us wildly. It became very quiet all around us.
You humiliated me!
Breck sat very still. So did we all.
I merely tricked you,
Breck said.
You fought well. You deserve better than to waste your time in the arena performing for these people.
Why did you kill me?
Cher said, his electronic voice cracking. His hand holding the pistol was shaking. I suddenly felt clammy all over.
Why should I?
Breck said, keeping his voice even.
I have nothing personal against you.
I challenged you!
And I accepted. And we fought. I won. You lost. It's over. Why not leave it at that? Sit down and join us for a drink.
You humiliated me!
Cher said again.
So back to the den! I want to work killing, was that it? I'm just a cripple and not good enough for you to kill! You should have killed me!
Allow me to remedy the oversight.
A plasma blast burned through from underneath the table and slammed into Cher's chest. Not even Nysteel can withstand a point-blank plasma blast. Cher fell to the floor, the stench of charred flesh and slagged Nysteel washing over us.
Damn you,
said Breck.
That was uncalled for. I could have handled it.
I only gave the poor fool what he wanted,
Razine said.
Or would you rather I'd let him shoot you?
I don't need you watching out for me.
It's what I'm being paid for,
Razine said.
I'll double whatever Sonoma's paying you,
said Breck.
Just get away from me.
I'm afraid I can't do that,
said Razine.
A man in my line of work loses credibility if he switches sides any time someone offers him more money. When I hire on to do a job, I finish it.
You're defeating the entire purpose of why Sonoma hired you,
said Stone.
Our experience is transmitted back to Psychodrome through the interface. The home audience knows full well why Carson Sonoma hired you. What does that say about the wonderful lifestyle in the Fire Islands?
Anyone who comes to the Fire Islands can hire a bodyguard,
said Razine.
You can hire as many bodyguards as you like, as many as you can afford. No one is attempting to deceive your home audience, Miss Winters. Tell me, who is safer? Someone who spends his time paying taxes, a portion of which goes toward paying policemen who will probably be elsewhere when you really need them, or someone who can take the same money he would pay as taxes back on Earth and spend it on exclusive 24-hour protection. In your case, the only difference is that you are receiving it free of charge, since you are visiting celebrities.
Does this protection we are being granted free of charge extend to the planet's surface as well?
Said Breck.
My job is over when you leave the Fire Islands,
Razine said.
My orders are to accompany you down to Draconis IX. You would benefit from my experience as a crystal hunter.
I think we could do without the benefit of your experience,
said Breck.
It would be unwise to discard any advantage you might have over an opposing team,
said Razine.
I understand there are several teams such as yours competing in this game scenario. The Combine has assigned corporate liaisons to each of them. Since I see one of my colleagues over there with those three people, I assume they are your competition.
Breck looked quickly in the direction Razine indicated. Four men were seated at a table several tiers above us. They were watching us. One of them smiled and raised his glass.
Spine Davies, said Stone flatly. Damn.
Breck nodded back at them.
It seems we have lost our advantage,
he said.
You recognize those men, O'Toole?
I shook my head. I was never a big fan of the game, remember?
Boris, Miss Davis, is the friendly-looking dark-haired man who toasted us,
said Breck.
Don't let his amiable looks deceive you. He is not very amiable at all. The other dark-haired man is Vittorio Paniti. He is rather amiable, but he does not let that get in the way of winning. And the large redhead is John Devlin, one of the game's new players. I don't know very much about him, but Paniti and Smith Davis I know well. They should make a formidable team.
Nice of Montego to let us know they had arrived, I said.
Montego only passes on essential information,
Breck said.
Of course, what he thinks is essential may not coincide with our view.
Smythe Davies was coming toward our table, moving down the aisle with practiced low-G kangaroo leaps. He was tall and slim, good-looking in a pretty boy way, with an easy manner and a charming smile.
Rudy, how nice to see you,
he said, sounding genuinely pleased. He spoke with a British accent.
That was quite an exhibition you put on. Truly impressive. And Stone, my old darling. How long has it been?
He bent down to kiss her, but she turned her face away. He raised his eyebrows.
What? Have I done something to offend? Or have I been supplanted in your affections?
He looked at me as he said that and winked. I hated him at once.
You must be O'Toole,
he said, offering his hand. I stood and shook hands with him, though I didn't really want to. He was one of those people whose insincerity was so obvious as to be insulting.
Doing very well your first time out, I hear,
he said. I'm trying my best, I said.
That's the ticket. I was afraid we might have missed you three. You jumped way out in the lead straight off. Had to work damned hard to catch up with you. Been down to the planet's surface yet?
Not yet, said Breck.
We were planning to take a shuttle down tomorrow morning. Just got in, you know. Help to get a good night's rest. Understand you've dealt with these draconian creatures before, Rudy. Any advice, in the spirit of friendly competition?
Yeah, Breck answered. Stay here. Don't even bother going down. You might never make it back.
You seem to have survived no less for wear,
Smythe Davies said with a grin.
Of course, we're not special service hybrids, but I think we'll chance it. May the best team win, eh?
He left with a jaunty wave.
Lays it on a bit thick, doesn't he?
I said.
He's been playing that act so long, I don't think he knows how to stop,
said Stone. So there was something between you? She gave me a direct look.
Just sex,
she said flatly.
Smythe Davies used to perform on the Lust channels with me. Is there anything else you'd like to know?
Razine cleared his throat slightly and pretended to be interested in the combat taking place in the arena. A group of bankrupts was involved in a melee. After what they had just seen, the audience was not terribly interested.
No,
I said uncomfortably.
I think that answers my question.
We should leave,
said Breck.
It is a safe bet that Zostrith will be going down tonight. I see no reason to give them a head start.
I can arrange passage down to the planet's surface almost immediately,
Razine said.
I have already taken care of the preliminaries and all the supplies.
Thank you,
Breck said.
That was very efficient of you.
Look, Breck,
said Razine.
We don't have to like each other, but perhaps we ought to clear the air. I think I can understand the sympathy you may have had towards Sarah. But the fact is, he has been trying to get himself killed ever since he came here. Only some men don't die easily, even if they want to. He was in a lot of pain, but he killed many people trying to ease that pain. If I had not fired when I did, he would have killed you and probably your friends as well. You were both disabled and cashiered from the service, only you were able to accept it and adjust. He never could. He challenged you because he resented you, and because there was a good chance you would kill him and end his misery. I don't expect your gratitude, nor do I desire it. But if you don't wish to be a hypocrite, dislike me for myself, not for having done my duty as I saw it, or is your own record in such things above reproach?
Breck gave him a long look.
Nine,
he said after a moment.
It is not. Your point is well taken. You have my apology.
It's unnecessary,
Racine said.
As long as we understand each other, I think we do. Now, if you don't wish to give your competition a head start, we'd best be on our way. I see they're leaving.
We weren't quite quick enough. The man the Combine had assigned to Smythe Davies' team was apparently as efficient as Razine. They had shuttled down just ahead of us, which technically put them in the lead. I wondered if they too had been briefed by Colonel Wren, and if the time we'd spent aboard Draconis Base had cost us, but it was pointless to dwell on that. Racine assured us that the fact that they had gone down before us didn't mean they'd find a crystal first. Besides, getting down to the planet's surface was the easy part. Getting back up in one piece was quite another story. Racine gave us his own briefing as we made the trip, but I was having a hard time paying attention. I kept thinking about Stone. For a while, back on Earth, we had achieved a real intimacy that now seemed to have dissipated. Perhaps it was my fault. It had been none of my business what she had done with Smythe Davies before she met me, and I knew I shouldn't have asked. But somehow I couldn't help myself. The answer I received had only served me right. Thought of the two of them together was repellent to me, even though she had never made any secret of her past or any excuses for it. She didn't owe me any explanations, but she had talked about it with me back in that hotel room. She had been honest with me, and she hadn't asked me for an accounting. I was the one who had been out of line. So why couldn't I let it go? I was reminded of a guy I knew back when I was in the service. We were both in the Supply Corps. He had fallen in love with a prostitute and asked her to marry him. He said it didn't matter to him what she was. All that mattered was that he loved her, and she loved him. And, to the best of my knowledge, she did love him. She had agreed to marry him, but he couldn't seem to reconcile her being a prostitute with her being his wife. What he said was one thing, but what went on inside was something else. It ate away at him. I believe he really loved her, but the responsibility for destroying that relationship was solely his. She tried. She put up with it as long as she could, but how do you live with someone who can't accept you for what you are? That includes accepting you for what you were. It wasn't enough that she stopped seeing other men as soon as they made a commitment to each other. He wanted to know how many men there had been. What kind of men were they? Who were they? And what had she done with them, and how often, and for how much? Never mind that he had been one of those men. I tried once, feeling very youthfully self-righteous, to point out to him that a man who buys the services of a prostitute is on pretty shaky grounds to condemn her for selling herself, but only drove him into a rage. It wasn't the same thing, he insisted. He loved her. Well, didn't she love him? Didn't she leave what was essentially a very lucrative profession to accept a much lower standard of living on a serviceman's pay? Wasn't she faithful to him? He didn't know. How could he know? What could fidelity mean to a whore? He punished himself for falling in love with her, perhaps for having gone to a prostitute in the first place. And, in so doing, he punished her and drove her away. I remember feeling sorry for him and thinking, again with very youthful self-righteousness, that he did not live a very well-examined life. Love, I thought with the simplistic logic of the inexperienced, was absolute. You either loved someone or you didn't. If you loved someone, you laid down the cards and accepted everything that went along with it. Well, I still believed that, but with the years had come the understanding that love is not a very simple thing at all. It can be frighteningly complex. It can trick you into all sorts of illogical rationalizations, because there's nothing very logical about being in love. It can make you forget your own flaws and be less forgiving of the flaws in others. It can cloud your perceptions and make you think reality is the way you think it ought to be, and not the way it is. And perhaps the most deadly side effect of that peculiar disease, it can make you think that because you love someone, or they love you, they ought to share your worldview. The Stone Winters I knew was not the same Stone Winters who had been the sex object of the lust channels. She had told me as much, and I should have known it without her needing to tell me. She woke up one day and took a look in the mirror and decided she didn't like what it showed her. And she looked her reflection squarely in the eye, accepted it, and proceeded to make changes. And what I had just done back in the arena was tell her that those changes didn't count. It was an indefensible position for me to take. As Razine had said to Breck, was my own record and such things beyond reproach? You're fool enough to think it is, O'Toole. Go ask Hakeem Sakara. Thinking of Sakara made me remember suddenly that I was not entirely alone, and I wondered with a guilty embarrassment exactly how much of my self-recrimination would be broadcast through the interface. And I wondered if Stone would tune in to the rerun, always assuming we made it back alive. I was having a hard time getting used to being a vehicle for the vicarious entertainment of the masses. I kept forgetting that they were there, if not truly inside my mind, then at least accessing some of my feelings. And every time I remembered, I felt as if I had dropped my pants in public. Get your mind back in the game, O'Toole. It can kill you if you don't pay attention. I had been aware, in a sort of offhand way, of what Razine had been telling us as the shuttle dropped down to Draconis 9. Much of it was a repetition of what had been in our game programming, but Razine either didn't know that or he wasn't taking anything for granted. Probably the latter, I thought, since his survival could easily depend on ours. There were two ground bases on Draconis 9, neither of which could properly be called spaceports. The Combine had paid for the construction, but they were maximum security military installations whose special service crews were rotated every 30 days. If it had been up to the SS, there would have been no ground bases at all. But since it wasn't their decision and the shuttles had to have a place to land, the SS was forced to supply the ground-based personnel. The frequent crew rotation was necessary because of the constant strain of maintaining the quarantine. I could understand Colonel Rent's desire to do something to discourage people from coming to the Fire Islands. He was an SS hybrid, designed to cope with the most adverse conditions, but the stress was getting to him. You could see it in his eyes, the beginning of that haunted look that comes to gamblers on a losing streak. I knew the look well. and the feeling. Your stake keeps getting smaller, and the best hand you've had all night is a pair of threes. You know you should fold them and get up from the table, but you can't. You tell yourself the odds have to improve. It's mathematically impossible to keep being dealt such lousy hands, but the cards don't seem to know that. And that's what Ren was going through. There were humans down there from the original development team, and there were humans down there who had come later, but who had made mistakes and now could not return. And the Draconians were learning from them, learning how to be more human. Sooner or later, the odds had to improve. A Draconian would break the quarantine. Maybe even more than one. And then what? The shuttle touched down on the runway, and suddenly, my mouth was dry. I was afraid. I wondered if that would make Hakeem Sakara happy. End of chapter.